From KUAR News in Little Rock, welcome to another edition of our weekly roundup of news, politics, and more. This week,
uncertainty over federal highway money propels a state task force to look at other options while yet another short-term fix heads through Congress. What are the implications for Arkansas?
A governor's council tasked with reviewing Common Core educational standards recommends another review of Common Core.
Grappling with an unwholesome legacy, the state Democratic Party chair toys with changing the name of its Jefferson Jackson dinner, and a Fort Smith High School changes the name of its mascot.
And 1 month after a landmark decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, a look at enduring challenges for LGBT rights in Arkansas.
All that's just ahead. I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
Well, let's get right to it. Yesterday, Jacob, you sat down with Michael Hiblin, our news director here at KUAR, and Jonathan Reeves, the news director over at KASU, to talk about federal highway funding.
Congress passed yet another short-term fix for a depleting federal highway trust fund set to run perilously low at the end of July. And what does it mean for Arkansas? Michael Hiblin, our news director at KUAR, joins us for this segment, as well as Jonathan Reeves at KASU in Jonesboro, appearing for the first time on our Week in Review podcast. Thanks, both of you, for joining me.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
All right. I spoke with Senator Bozeman earlier this week on Tuesday before the final votes were cast in what is going to be this yet another short-term extension of the Federal Highway Trust Fund. And basically, we had competing versions between Arkansas's Republicans in the House and Arkansas's Republican representatives in the Senate. And the Senate, as a whole, they wanted to support a six-year federal highway bill. It only provides funding for 3 years out of the six, though, but still a more long-term solution. It's something they wanted pretty badly. And in the House, they offered a three-month version saying that, well, they really needed to wait to figure out what to do, how to fund a long-term bill. They needed more time. And Senator Bozeman, speaking to me on Tuesday, talked about how even though this bill had an unwanted attachment in the form of the Export-Import Bank, he still voted for it because he thought the long-term solution was worth it.
I think it was pretty well known that in return for getting some more Democratic support in regards to the Trade Promotion Authority, that he agreed that we would have a vote on XM at some point. Stuck into the bill, and the reality is that I think almost everyone knew that and understood it. We also understood that there was tremendous support for the bill, and that at some point it would pass. So I think it's really a moot issue.
So that's kind of interesting to me that Senator Bozeman, who's opposed to the Export-Import Bank, which is a federal entity, the entity that supports international trade through various subsidies and insurances that Americans for Prosperity, for example, really opposes, that even though that made it on the bill, he really does not like the idea of a short-term extension. And this is what he told me about opposing a short-term extension, even though he voted for it this week.
Well, I think, we're just getting down to the wire. And so I don't know exactly what's going to happen over the next few days. I'm very concerned about the effects, though, of a three-month extension, because it really doesn't do anything for our highways commissioner's inability to let these contracts. So it just puts everything on hold. So I'm going to continue to work hard, that we go forward with a six-year bill. If there's nothing else out there at some point, then we'll probably go with a very short-term extension and try and get this worked out. And then have a bill, a good six-year bill that our commissioners need, our planners need to know that they're going to have that stream of money coming in so that they can go ahead and move forward. Roads take a long time and they're very expensive, and that's why we've always had 5-6 year bills. Sadly, it's been a long time, I think since 2009 or so, since we've been able to put one of these together. Had 30 some odd extensions, which again is simply inappropriate.
And in the end, Senator Bozeman was forced in a way to vote because there was no other option besides this House version. The House went on recess on Wednesday for 5 weeks. One could say you don't have to go to recess necessarily. But Michael, you reported on in Arkansas some of what Bozeman was talking about the effects on state highway commissioners.
Well, on that same day, Jacob, on Tuesday, the governor's working group on highway funding met. This group has mainly been focused on the shortfall on the state end when it comes to highway funding. Right now, Arkansas budgets about $900 million annually for highways. $490 million of that comes from the federal government. $410 million comes from the state government. 80% of that goes toward maintenance of roadways and bridges, and 20% toward capital improvements or new projects. But this group was called by the governor to look at the state's end of this, a funding shortfall that in large part is being blamed on the fuel tax, which hasn't been changed in about two decades, and the fact that vehicles are getting better mileage, so there's less money coming into the state. And this group has been meeting to try and figure other solutions, find different ways to do funding. But during the meeting, Scott Bennett, the director of the Arkansas Highway and Transportation Department, spoke about what was going on in Washington at that exact time. In fact, there were points during the meeting even where some of the members interrupted and said, well, you know, I just got a text that said the House is passing this. It was playing out almost at the same time. So here's Scott Bennett, and also during this, he takes a question from State Representative Prissy Hickerson, a Republican from Texarkana, but just saying that this short-term fix really doesn't help the department much. They've had to push off so many projects already that just a three-month extension really doesn't do much for the department.
We believe we manage and control everything that we can as best we can, but there's just so much of it that's beyond our control, and it's never been more evident than now with what's going on in Washington. And you can see, I mean, if we've got, you know, $490 million of our revenue, over half of our revenue coming from federal sources, we rely a lot on what happens in Washington. 3 months will get you till the end of October. That might let us do a few of the withdrawn projects, but it's still, they kicked the can down the road and it landed in a pothole, so I'm not sure they can kick it anymore.
Yeah, Senate has to do something.
Senate still has to do something, and they're still working on that six-year bill to try to get it passed.
Thank you, Scott. Any other questions on the federal funding, federal update? Representative Hickerson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Bennett, I would like to see if you all have any type of analysis, what fiscal impact this has had on the state of Arkansas in terms of revenue, loss, jobs, you know, that type of thing, on our economy, just the projects that have had to be pulled. Because I know this is affecting our economy in every state that has had to delay or pull projects. It has to, and it's going to get worse.
It's had an impact on almost 7,500 jobs around the state because of the number of jobs that a highway construction project either creates or sustains. So that means there's 7,500 jobs around the state that would have been either created or would have been supported by that highway work that we've had to pull. That's pretty substantial. And I know, I mean, there are contractors around the state that have had to either shuffle people around or lay people off already. So it has had a definite direct impact already.
So they continue pushing back, taking bids on projects going forward. We have had several significant projects that have recently been completed. We mentioned on the podcast a couple of weeks ago the Big Rock Interchange in Little Rock finally being completed. But going forward for new projects, there have been big delays. Well, the day after this hearing, Scott Bennett, director of the Highway Department, was in Northeast Arkansas in Paragould. And Jonathan Reeves with KASU was there covering it. Jonathan, first, what was the project that they had the dedication ceremony for there
Yeah, back in 1963, Perigold came up with an idea to be able to maybe have a bypass that would take traffic around the city. And many long years later, the portion of it, which is the eastern portion of the bypass, was dedicated on Wednesday. They'll be working on the western bypass starting in latter part of 2016. The significance for that is that we're seeing a lot of traffic in northeast Arkansas. Jonesboro and Perigold are two cities that continue to grow exponentially. And with that, there's a lot of traffic that's being taken between both cities, which are about 20 miles apart from each other on Highway 49. Highway 49 is a four-lane road, and a lot of traffic goes back and forth. There's a lot of people who will commute from one city to the other, and there's also a lot of truck traffic as well, and we're seeing more of that on the highway. What this bypass will do is it will take those big trucks, mainly the big trucks, and will be able to take them off of the downtown area and then divert them over to Highway 412, which is also a four-lane highway that would take them over towards the Mississippi River if they're going eastbound on 412. So that was a dedication of that. Once again, the western part of that will start in latter part of 2016. And while I was there on Wednesday, got a chance to talk to Director Bennett. And what I saw Wednesday morning, Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam, who is a Republican in that state, has been launching a tour of Tennessee to discuss the transportation funding challenges that his state is facing. And he's going to be he's going to try to push for an increase of the state's gas tax for the first time in 25 years. In the soundbite that you'll hear, I asked him if Arkansas would do something like that. And here's what he had to say.
That's something that is being talked about now, along with a lot of other options. Governor Hutchinson has established a highway funding study group. The group has had two meetings so far, and a lot of the information in the two meetings has been, you know, the history of needs and funding at the state level. We know that we need more investment for highway improvements at the state level. The question is always going to be, how do you get there? Motor fuel taxes have been the traditional way to generate revenue for highways, both at the federal and the state level, but consumption is declining. And when consumption is declining and motor fuel taxes are based on a gallon of fuel that you buy, that means that your revenue is declining. But at the same time, people are driving more. There are more miles being driven. People are just using more fuel-efficient vehicles. And I think the talk at the state and the federal level is whether the fuel tax is a sustainable way to provide investment for highway improvements or whether we need to find some other source of revenue.
And some of those other sources that they're talking about include, of course, one thing that has been talked about in the past is possibly turning Interstate 40 from Memphis to Little Rock into a toll road. There are also some other funding recommendations from the study group. Some of those include a 10-year phased-in transfer of the sales tax that is currently collected on the sale of new and used vehicles, tires, batteries, and vehicle parts and services, and also allowing the citizens to vote on a temporary 10-year, 1.5-cent general sales tax dedicated to a statewide bond-financed highway improvement program. Those are just two of several funding recommendations that group is looking at, and they'll be continuing to look at more of those and also be meeting more in the future as we try to find out where do we go from here and to be able to try and generate some of our own revenue, since a lot of state officials like Scott Bennett are concerned about what the federal government is going to do.
Yeah, and Jonathan, I know also that at the meeting I was at, there was also discussion about tractor-trailer, where taxes come from for those vehicles. Also, they wanted more information, and they had one of the officials from the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration, John Tice, speak to them to detail revenue that comes from different sources. He answered questions about things like compressed natural gas, which is being used in some vehicles, especially heavier vehicles like trucks or buses, for instance, here in Little Rock. Central Arkansas Transit is just about to get its first CNG-fueled buses. So there was some concern about, are we losing revenue there at this point? He said less than a 1,000 vehicles statewide licensed to run on that kind of fuel. They also spoke about electric cars, and he said there are fewer than 1,000 electric cars in Arkansas at this point, but at some point, as they continue to grow, you might have to find ways to use technology to assess mileage driven and find different ways do this.
The idea of looking at the trucking industry and transportation and logistics, is it still kind of, it's in a way still part of that traditional user fee, but also it's because of the sheer weight of these vehicles and volume of them. The argument is that they have a disproportionate amount of damage, so that if anyone should be responsible for maintenance or future construction of these things, maybe it should be the heaviest users of them. Jonathan, I guess I had a question for you. We often hear that Jonesboro is one of the biggest cities in the state that doesn't have access to an interstate, sort of close to one. Does that seem like a pipe dream at this point? In Little Rock, we're discussing just this week the approval of a I-30 study across the Arkansas River through downtown Little Rock that would cost around $450 million. So even though there's talk of cuts, there's still big projects going on. But what do you think the future of transportation in Jonesboro looks like?
You know, that's a good question, because one of the things we're looking at right now, not far from the studios where I'm at right now, is there is a sign that says Future Interstate 555, but that's been up for a while. Highway 63 goes right from Jonesboro, and it's a four-lane road that is basically interstate ready, that goes right towards and will connect to Interstate 55 right around the Marion area. One of the problems is there was a stretch of about 3 or 4 miles where there was not an access road, and it's around the Painway area. And that's been a problem, and that is actually something that would cost about $15, $16 million to build an access road. And one of the reasons why that's a problem is because it's over a series of ditches and canals where you have the regular highway that's there, but you have a need to be able to build more bridges and build a service road there. One of the things that they're working on is trying to get the congressional delegation, including Rick Crawford, the first district representative, to be able to change the language on that, to be able to basically exempt the highway from some of the regulations that would go on a regular interstate, which would be able to make it a little bit easier for that interstate to be, instead of a highway like Highway 67 is, it's initially what Highway 63 is right now, just to be able to change the rules a little bit and be able to remove some of the language to go ahead and make it Interstate 555. That's something that a lot of local leaders around the area are pushing for, because they say basically the highway is interstate ready. It's basically ready to go. The only thing that's preventing it is that little area, which is $17, $18 million. And of course, as we've been talking about, funding is an issue. If that language can be if it can be exempt, if it can be changed a little bit, then that might help make it the new Interstate 555, which would be good for business and industry and other areas. So right now, local officials are really hoping that something can work there in Congress. They're just waiting to see what happens on that.
I will add that at this point, the governor's working group on highway funding will continue holding meetings. The one on Tuesday was the second meeting. They have several more meetings planned between now and the end of the year, and they're expected to issue recommendations to the governor by December 15th. And this is the governor has been big at naming groups to address these kind of challenges for the state. And there are issues like raising the gas tax that are extremely unpopular. In fact, during the meeting, it was almost brought up in a joking way. They didn't mention him by name, but it was brought up that in 1980, a governor at that time passed an increase in the highway tax that was extremely unpopular and was thought to be a factor in him being voted out of office. Of course, talking about then-Governor Bill Clinton, who did get voted out of office then in the fall of 1980, spent one term out before coming back. But at this point, the gas tax is 21.5 cents per gallon. That hasn't changed since 2001. And I don't think Governor Hutchinson wants to, on his own, make a decision that could prove to be very unpopular. If it is done by a group of officials, and those who make up this group include many state representatives. Director Scott Bennett is among them. You have a wide group of different people, and it will be easier for him to make the decision to increase the gas tax if he has the backing of a lot of other state leaders in this way.
Well, I remember at the beginning of the last legislative session, the state highway department was calling for a big increase in money, and they didn't necessarily get it, or didn't seem they were listened to as much as they might have wanted to. But it seems like if we're going to have more roads, it looks the direction might be that states need to pick up more of the tab on this, or drivers maybe pay some of that fee. But we'll see after the 5-week recess in Congress whether or not they do come back before October to figure out a long-term fix, or maybe the legislature will have to tackle it first. We'll have to see.
And Jonathan, you were going to say something?
One of the things also they were talking about is they're really encouraging cities to get involved and be able to kind of help in funding some of the projects. And they say the more the cities can get involved in this, then they're going to be able to see more and more projects turn out if the cities kind of bear some of that. And then also I talked to Scott Bennett on Wednesday, and he said three things that they kind of take a look at when they're that they decide to do by way of moving forward with this. He says three criteria. First of all, it has to be understandable by the public. Second of all, you have to make sure that the needs are clear. And then third, of course, has to pass the legislature as well. So it's going to be something that will be very interesting to see what they come up with at the end of the year. But he said those three criteria, what they're looking at to make sure that it's understandable by the public and that those needs will be clearly met through there. But then we'll see what happens in the next legislative session.
Michael Hiblin with KUAR, our news director, thank you for joining us for this segment and for your coverage on highways this week.
You bet.
Jonathan Reeves, the new news director at KASU in Jonesboro, thanks for joining us for the first time on the podcast.
Thank you. It was great. I really enjoyed it. I hope I can come back.
So this week, one of the biggest stories was a 16-member council reconvening once again to recommend changes to the governor on Common Core educational standards in Arkansas. This task force was chaired by Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin. It has been a topic of our podcast before. In fact, last week, we all made our own predictions about what was going to happen.
Sarah, do you want to make a prediction and we'll find out next podcast if you're a good reporter or not?
Well, I think they'll keep the Common Core. I mean, that seems obvious to me, but... Yeah.
Chris, any want to wager anything?
No, I don't want to risk it.
And Jacob?
I'll risk my reputation. They're going to keep Common Core.
Okay, well, we'll find out a week from now.
Now, it has been a week, and Jacob, you went to this council meeting. What is this all about? What are we talking about in terms of Common Core? What did they decide? Were our predictions correct?
It seems like the predictions were correct, and the decision was unanimous from the Common Core Task Force, which, you know, so if you want to be cynical, you might expect, because they're all appointees of the governor, so, you know, he could have had like-minded people together. But basically, they decided to keep Common Core in place while studying ways to possibly replace it. So I spoke with one advocate who's a parent advocate who is opposed to Common Core, and she really pointed to the removal of the park test, which was an earlier recommendation, as one of the most significant things that came out of this. And she also celebrated it sort of as a victory, but she thinks that in the future, the next review, that there will be big replacements to Common Core.
I'm happy that we got out of park testing for one. That was a huge, huge win for us. I'm happy that we're going to get the public discourse that we should have had 5 years ago with regard to establishing new standards for our state.
And that was Karen Lamoureux, who lives in Pulaski County. But I spoke with Education Commissioner Johnny Key, and one of the things that comes out of this report is instead of having this task force, which was parents and educators, and a few lawmakers like Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin, it will instead go to education officials at the Department of Education and the State Board of Education. So in a way, it's kind of kicking the review to the technocrats, to the experts, the Department of Education, which is kind of the opposite, the idea of this task force and a listening tour that talks to regular people. But Commissioner Johnny Key said, while there is going to be this further review, in a sense, it was already planned.
We're already going to embark on a review and revision process for our math and literacy standards. We have a process that's set forth by statute and in state board rules.
And so, Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin will say, when the governor will help shape this process heavily with some of these recommendations. And the big takeaway seems to be the lieutenant governor will say, well, we are keeping Common Core in place right now. When we review the standards, we don't want people to be worried about if you make a change here in math or a change here in literacy, that somehow it'll take us out of the Common Core orbit or not align us closely enough to call it Common Core anymore. So they're saying, look at the Arkansas standards first and let it lay where it does with Common Core in the end. But Commissioner Johnny Key also said, well, that's true, but we still want national we want a set of standards that we can have national comparisons with that are still as rigorous.
There's an opportunity to tailor those standards to make sure that they meet the needs of the individual state without getting away from that core set of standards that are high level that create the ability to compare, state to state. But again, Common Core state standards, that is a brand of standards, that's a name brand that's been placed on them. We have been a part of that. If the governor chooses an effort to, I won't say create new standards, but to make sure we revise and improve on the standards we have now, that's what we should be doing.
So some echoes of maybe what the Medicaid Task Force will do in a certain sense, maybe rebrand it, do some tailoring, but they still might have an interest in staying within federal waivers to keep the current funding models. But Sarah, you've been covering all these task force meetings leading up to this decision all summer. Anything about this surprise you? Did you expect it to be any different?
This doesn't much surprise me, Jacob. The issues that they mentioned having to do with implementation of Common Core being imbalanced, I heard that come up in the task force meetings, also the concerns about some of the math standards, and then, of course, the park test and the time that that took to complete. So it sounds like this recommendation is about opening up a process of review so that these standards could be revisited and also could be modified. And I think just clarifying what they actually do and what role teachers and districts and Department of Education and other public interested parties will actually play in carrying them out, which to me speaks to this issue of uneven implementation and confusion around the implementation. As Karen Lemro said, there wasn't really a public implementation process or public dialogue. So it seems to me that this actually doesn't really change too much, except just sort of establishes a process for going forward with Common Core.
Did it seem like the expectations during these meetings, though, that this would be a body that produces really specific recommendations instead of saying, well, when there's another review, please keep these things in mind?
There were entire days dedicated to reviewing the literacy standards and the math standards. So I could only take this to mean that, in a sense, it's a full-blown acceptance of Common Core while allowing educators to understand a little bit more how they might have leeway within using those standards.
It's kind of interesting to me. Karen Lamoureux did not interpret it to mean Common Core is continuing, even it is continuing. And she acknowledged, but she would say, well, the governor, as the Department of Education reviews it, is supposed to replace standards that they think are should be replaced. So it's kind of like the Medicaid Task Force again, is that, well, the private option got to be continued for 2 years, but also some opponents of it would say, well, that measure ends the private option while we study how to replace it. So it's kind of interesting. We'll see what happens. And as Johnny Key said, they'll finish the state review in August of next year.
Yeah, and Karen Lamoureux has been one of the most vocal opponents leading that group, Arkansans Against Common Core. But it seems to me also one of the takeaways of this is that it seems like, given that vocal opposition, these standards themselves are kind of slowly integrating themselves into the mainstream of Republican thought here in the state, or at least they're being more accepted here.
Yeah, I was at Arkansas Week at AATN earlier today, and Hal Bass, who's a political science professor at Ouachita Baptist University, we talked about this, and he said it's kind of an intra-party split among Republicans, although it is a bipartisan kind of thing about Common Core, but between social conservatives and business conservatives. And business conservatives are really interested in, you need education to have national standards so we can compare Arkansas graduates and Arkansas's workforce to workforces in other states.
Well, of course, Randy Zook, the Chamber of Commerce leader in Little Rock, spoke in favor of the standards, and the business community has been behind Common Core. and was involved in calling for it on a national level. So I'm sure that had an influence on the Republican Party. As far as Karen Lamoureux's opposition, it seems like a matter of semantics at this point. I was almost so surprised to hear her be quoted as saying that she was really pleased with this, because it doesn't really seem to actually change anything as far as I can tell.
The Lieutenant Governor, though, after this unanimous vote, though, on the steps to the Senate chambers in the Capitol, he was being interviewed, and he was saying things like, well, when we have the review of education standards with the governor and the Department of Education, you know, somebody asked him, like, will those reviews, does it have to align with Common Core? And he'll say, well, no, we just said we don't have to keep Common Core. So, I mean, it's a lot of people can see this a lot of different ways. But in his mind, when we go forward with the review process, we're not supposed to care whether or not it keeps us in Common Core. So he thinks it's a license for flexibility to get out of it. Possibly.
All right. Well, moving on. This week, in the wake of the shooting, the terrible shooting in South Carolina, of 9 African Americans at a historic church. I mean, we've seen a debate over the Confederate flag, Confederate battle flag in South Carolina, other Confederate imagery here across the South and in Arkansas. And Jacob, you reported on this last week of the prevalence of Confederate monuments throughout the state and the controversy over that. This week, we saw a couple of issues kind of stemming out of this. One was the Fort Smith High School banning its use of the Dixie fight song and the rebel mascot. And also, our state Democratic Party chair, Vincent Insulaco, kind of voicing some reservations over the Democratic Party's naming of the Jefferson Jackson dinner. Now, of course, Jefferson Jackson, they don't have anything explicitly to do with the Confederacy, but, you know, as we know, Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, was a slaveholder. Andrew Jackson was notorious for the forced removal of Native Americans throughout the South into the West, into reservation areas. You spoke with people in Fort Smith as well as in Sulaco about these things. It seems to me that, you know, this conversation is continuing and is developing in other areas. First of all, tell us what happened in Fort Smith with the mascot.
In Fort Smith, this Fort Smith Southside High School, it's one of two or three high schools I think they have. And Fort Smith is, of course, one of the state's biggest cities. They opened this high school, Southside High School, in the 60s in the context of the civil rights movement, in the context of all these national laws trying to desegregate society. And so they opened the school. They called it Southside. They made Johnny Reb their mascot. They have Dixie Bells are their cheerleaders. Their volleyball team is called the Volleyball Confederates or something to that effect. So it's something that clearly the context of these symbols at this school at least came up in that civil rights era. The school itself didn't have very many black students, only a handful, I think, by the 80s. But I spoke with the president of the Board of Education, their school board up there, and she said this is something that she's been in office for 10 years, that she gets dozens of complaints every year from people. And she especially gets complaints from students and parents from other schools, schools like Central, she pointed to, when they come to play Southside sports. Students and parents will talk about how they like Fort Smith, they like playing at the other school, Northside, but they hate playing at Southside, they hate hearing Dixie and having the Johnny Reb mascot walk around. So they voted unanimously, even though there's been a lot of Confederate flag rallies up there, they've drawn hundreds of people, to discontinue these symbols or to phase them out in the years ahead.
On the other side of things, Vincent Insulaco of the State Democratic Party voiced concern this week that, you know, they might want to change their Jefferson Jackson dinner. Could you talk about, like, what his reasoning behind that was?
It comes out of the national debate over, you know, starting with police brutality, moving on to other things and Confederate imagery recently. So I guess it's just in general a lot of American society is reevaluating the ways we use any type of historic figures or symbols. And Democrats especially, because they're the progressive party, who are more interested in looking at these types of interpretations and to see what our historical memory is. So certain other state Democratic parties in Connecticut, Georgia, I believe, and maybe even Missouri, so other southern states, they've gotten rid of their Jefferson Jackson dinner, which is basically like the big annual gathering of a state Democratic Party, or at least it is in Arkansas. So it's their signature event where they raise funds. Hillary Clinton spoke at it. And even Jackson's home state of Tennessee is reconsidering it, so it's clearly part of the national Democratic Party discussion too. But Vincent Insulaco, the Democratic Party of Arkansas chair, you know, he had a pretty nuanced view saying, hey, Jefferson Jackson are, you know, legends of American history that are worthy of plenty of praise, but also he thinks, no, their values certainly do not fit in contemporary society.
I want to just remind everybody, Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence and Andrew Jackson saved the Union. Now, having said that, you know, it's if you look at it in that context, it's pretty remarkable. They're pretty remarkable men. But I would rather it be, I think in today's world, it be a more diverse name that recognized people who have given things to the Democratic Party on a more contemporary level.
And Insulaco declined to give a timeline for this. I asked him if they'd change it by next year, and he said he didn't want to be held to a timeline. And it's exclusively his power and authority to change the name, but he said he'd likely form a committee to look at it. But, you know, for what it's worth, the head of the Democratic Party of Arkansas thinks it should probably be changed.
And he said it's an old discussion. It's been going on for quite a while. Obviously, you know, we're all familiar with the legacies of these two men and also familiar with the legacies of countless other members of the Democratic Party, which, like he said, may be more in line with the value system of the modern Democratic Party.
Well, it's interesting to think about this in light of what Democratic presidential candidates are saying about race. There was an interesting story on Morning Edition this morning about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and others speaking about the Black Lives Matter movement and how they initially were hedging what they were saying and sort of saying, you know, all lives matter, white lives matter, and had to backtrack and apologize and acknowledge this new movement. So I think the willingness for the Arkansas State Democratic Party to now address this longstanding question of slavery ties and Indian removal ties to names and symbolic figures is interesting. And the Arkansas Times had an article where the police chief was quoted talking about his decision to outfit several hundred officers with riot gear following, you say, you call it post-Baltimore. It's interesting, these recent events that have taken on their own symbolic importance that are pushing conversations in all different ways playing out here on the local level still.
And following my longstanding tradition of reading too much into Twitter, Candace Martin, who used to be the spokesman of that Democratic Party, she just stepped down from that position recently. She put something on there. There's an article from Mother Jones magazine, which is a leftist labor type magazine, saying it was about how red state Democrats are fretting about the national shift leftward. So it's definitely a discussion they're having on all sorts of levels.
All right. Well,
Jacob, I wonder what you think, what Democratic figures would be viable replacements for Jefferson and Jackson here?
That's a good game we could play.
Maybe Roosevelt or something.
Roosevelt, yeah, I think they don't have to be dead for this game. They could be living figures, certainly. So I'd go with like a Bumper's BB Brunch, the Pryor Family Supper. But supper is a Southern thing.
Do you think that BB
Clinton
and
Bates.
Pryor are far enough out of office to have that not be kind of awkward?
Oh, I guess it could be plenty awkward. Well, that's part of it too. Is they can't just get rid of it. It's somebody that they want to have in place for another 50 or 100 years. This is a 150-plus-year tradition to have this Jefferson Jackson name, I understand. But Insulaco, he said that whatever name we pick, I fully expect in 100 years for that society to say, we've evolved from there. These people don't represent us anymore. And he said, that's fine. That's what the Democratic Party is all about.
Presumably, there will be a civil rights leader to considered for the name.
You'd think so. I mean, there's plenty of historic civil rights leaders in Arkansas to claim that consider themselves Democrats. Chris, you got any suggestions?
Well, I hope they don't use Arkansas's most notoriously bad governor, Jeff Davis.
Notoriously bad because of his name?
No, he was just a very terrible governor in lots of ways. A demagogue.
Early 1900s.
Yeah.
Well, that's a name that you're born into, being a demagogue to some
degree. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, the Democratic Party in Arkansas doesn't necessarily have a clean history, and some of the largest figures in the state, especially from Faubus and beforehand, you know.
I don't think there'll be a Faubus dinner.
Yeah, no, obviously not. But, I mean, that's kind of the Democratic Party here in the state doesn't necessarily have a clean history with lots of upstanding figures, because they were the one party that ruled over, you know, years and years and generations of racial segregation and Jim Crow. So
different party today.
Yeah. So I agree. They might have to, if they were to choose a state figure, it would have to be somebody more modern.
Maybe Bill Clinton.
But that might, given that Hillary is running, I mean, would that maybe complicate things?
Maybe they'll wait until after the election.
But if they do have time, I mean, like, will this national conversation about race and legacies of our tarnished past, you know, still be going on, or will it have petered out by then?
Well, it is kind of interesting that many people have spent their whole life thinking about race, and all of a sudden it's a national topic of great importance. So the question is this a fad? Is this changing the world? What lasting impact will it inevitably have just by having gained such popular attention? Well, and also at this stage, is the conversation largely about symbols? You know, the original civil rights movement, ultimately, a large part of it focused on legal changes, and it sounds like the Black Lives Matters organizers are coming together now and talking about really specific agenda that they're pushing for, but it doesn't seem that has really been, you know, developed yet. So I guess the question is, what specifically is this about? And in Arkansas, is there a conversation pushing, using the momentum of recent events to demand specific changes, formulate a political movement? What do you guys think?
I guess I think in Arkansas that there's not a lot of support for that movement in general, I think. I mean, the state is pretty Republican everywhere, and I think most of the people would agree with the phrase "all lives matter" and would prefer that to "Black Lives Matter." And of course, the criticism of that is that by saying "all lives matter," you're being dismissive of the idea that there's a particular stress for one population.
I mean, I guess it depends on what people were talking about. I went to a couple of community forums, African American community forums, around policing months ago, and I heard the police chief say that it, rather than focus on the police department and the extent to which officers have used excessive force, you know, focus on your own backyard, focus on the inner African black on black killing rates in Little Rock, and he sort of spoke to what he referred to as like the sort of faddish focus on Ferguson, places outside of the state where people are getting worked up, and was really discouraging of any kind of developing, I guess, of a political conscience or a more aggressive approach to accountability.
On a local level.
And obviously I'm no expert whatsoever, and we would need to ask leaders of the local African American community whether or not those conversations have continued.
Well, I think what you pointed to earlier, that following this, the police chief wanting to get riot gear in reference to the things going on in Baltimore and Ferguson. You can see in the city politics that a citywide minimum wage is not an issue at all among the leaders of the city. There's not a police citizens advisory council. Baker Curris, the new Little Rock Schools District superintendent, he said there wasn't such a thing as an African-American community before. Politicians, I can't imagine any of the Arkansas congressional representatives would want to identify or align themselves with this movement at all. So, I mean, even the symbolic battles in Arkansas don't gain any steam.
There was a group, I think they were called All Action. They kind of were inspired by, you know, events in Ferguson to draw attention to police community relations here. They did a march like in November, and I interviewed somebody with them, but I haven't heard much lately of any what, you know, they've been up to, or if they're still organized or if they're still doing things. I mean, and this is slightly different, but I mean, I went last week to the Little Rock Crime or the Capital City Crime Prevention Task Force meeting, and there, I mean, it's mostly city officials, members of the police, Department of Community Correction were there to discuss, you know, how to prevent crime in the city and how to foster better relationships or provide economic opportunity. But there wasn't, from what I could tell, too much representation from the community itself outside of that, I guess, the power structure or the elected structure that governs.
Well, I guess one manifestation of frustration, at least with the criminal justice system, had that happened this week in Jefferson County and their county jail, where 80 inmates rioted in response to some of their privileges being restricted and burned some of their living quarters or destroyed some of their living quarters. So that's one snapshot into the criminal justice system and how people feel about it.
All right. Well, it's been 1 month since landmark Supreme Court decision ruling that same-sex marriage is legal in every state and every state has to recognize same-sex marriages. Meanwhile, their advocates and conservative lawmakers here in Arkansas are still arguing about whether a new state law can truly ban municipal anti-discrimination ordinances. And Sarah, you had a conversation this week with a law professor at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville about a federal equality act that was introduced last week, now that U.S. Congress is about to go into session. They'll be returning, and they'll have to take up this proposal.
Yeah, I spoke with a law professor at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, Danielle Weatherby. She spoke with me about the likelihood of this bill passing and of the type of legislation she thinks we might see ahead here in the state around adoption rights for same-sex couples and possibly bills that would allow county clerks to have some avenue to refuse marrying same-sex couples. And then also asked her, you know, how discrimination is playing out in Arkansas. Is it really an issue? And she spoke to me about her experience and her take on what might be the next phase of civil rights issues for same-sex couples.
I think it would decide the issue once and for all if Congress passes a bill like the Equality Act, which would provide protections for the LGBT community in 8 different areas, including employment, housing, and public accommodations. It would be clear that federal law would provide those protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, and therefore any local municipality that tried to pass legislation that would also grant rights or protections to the LGBT community would be doing so in concert with what's already existing in federal law.
What are the odds, do you think, that will be successful?
I unfortunately am not optimistic. You know, this is a Republican-controlled Congress right now, and since the Employment Non-Discrimination Act has failed every single time it's been proposed and considered in Congress, and that act was limited to protections in the workplace based on gender identity and sexual orientation. It's not likely that this law will pass, since this Equality Act is much more broad-sweeping than the Employment Non-Discrimination Act.
I know the Human Rights Campaign has done surveys and found that LGBT Arkansans experience a high level of discrimination, and then, of course, sponsors of the ordinance ban, you know, are saying that there isn't discrimination. What's actually at stake here as far as the legal protections that may or may not exist for people?
Well, I think there's a great deal at stake. The reason why you're not hearing about legal cases brought through the Arkansas court system is because there is no mechanism for individuals to seek a remedy for discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. Not only is there no mechanism to seek relief through the court system, but there's no mechanism to even report alleged discrimination in the workplace, in places of public accommodation, or in housing. So just because we're not hearing it doesn't mean it's not happening. And in fact, in my travels, based on what I do, I have encountered many folks in the LGBT community who have described anecdotes of severe discrimination and harassment in those areas. So I think it's happening. It's just that this state doesn't have a mechanism for reporting and keeping track of incidents and providing relief for the victims of discrimination and harassment on those bases.
So do you see any viable legal avenues for limiting the rights of LGBT people in Arkansas, either in favor of religious rights or through some other channel?
What I see happening is that conservative Republican legislators will introduce bills to the state assembly that would have that effect of allowing individuals to discriminate on the basis of gender identity and or sexual orientation. For example, the law that would allow city clerks to refuse marriage certificates to same-sex couples, or the law that would allow religious-based adoption agencies to refuse adoption rights to same-sex parents. These are the types of legislative measures I envision seeing pop up as a reaction to the court same-sex marriage decision.
Professor Weatherby, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
All right, well, that concludes our July 31st edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Thanks for joining us. You can find our podcast posted on our website, KUAR.org. You can also subscribe to it in iTunes. And KUAR is a listener-supported service, but editorially independent of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Thanks for joining us. I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
See you next week.